In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We listen to the second part of the interview with Dr. Paulo Correa. We talk about his friendship with Dr. Eugene Maloff and the corrupt scientific reviews of the cold fusion experiments, and also the potential funding of Dr. Correa's work and research on vacuum energy concepts. Dr. Correa corrected the intentionally misleading U.S. government reviews on cold fusion in a document titled Correa's Solution to the Cold Fusion Enigma. The orgone motor is a stepping stone to understanding the etheric realm for a potential energy source. But Dr. Correa suggests pulsed plasma, vacuum energy, and cold fusion are primary paths for the direction of future energy sources. We go now to hear the second part of the interview with Dr. Paulo Correa, who is Research and Design Director of the Aurora Biophysics Research Institute. He's a biophysicist, molecular biologist, hematologist, political scientist, author, and inventor. Let's have a listen.
This all goes back to Nikola Tesla's dream of plugging our electrical machinery into the real works of nature, as he used to say. As you know, he actually was the inventor of the induction motor. Well, okay, Ferrari also at the same time in Italy. But we owe today almost the entirety of our basic electrical infrastructure from AC to Niagara Falls to Nikola Tesla. Now, he actually was the first fellow to come up with the principles of the so-called orgone motor. And, you know, it begins, of course, with getting understanding how to create a motor with the right starter and the right rotor that permits it to develop a continuous motor action using, let's say, an AC signal or a pulsed signal, which are different things. But it all goes back to him. And then what did he do? I mean, there's a lecture that he gave in 1893, if I recall properly, at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, and also some pictures that he showed in his lecture about increasing the problem of increasing human energy much later. They referred to the same experiment. What he did do was he used a Tesla coil. That's a form of, if you will, induction coil, where the primary and secondary operate by the proportionality of their capacitances, not necessarily by the proportionality of their inductances. And he built in a field a variety of, you know, capture circuits that were resonant. In this case, you know, the coils were identical to the emitting secondary. And he was able to capture in any place in this field significant currents that, you know, he described as being currents that were up there on the 90%, 95% of the emitting current. Probably that only applies if it's a single receiver. In his field where he had several, I'm pretty sure that that wouldn't apply to all of them. But his view was not so much that he was extracting energy from the vacuum state. It was that, I think it's one of those lectures, he mentions how in the future, when the planet will be deforested and there'll be no more coal to burn and so on, that all we'll be left with is the transmission of power. That's what he was actually after. And he was the discovery of the actual radio transmission. It was not Marconi. That's one of the great injustices of the U.S. patenting system that denied this patent. Finally, you know, somewhat, you know, 15 years ago, they put it back, you know, so posthumously that it's a joke, that indeed they recognized that Nikola Tesla was the one who actually should have received the patent for the propagation of radio signals. But what was the fundamental difference? And Tesla pointed this out many times, was that whereas Marconi and others were only looking at transmission across the atmosphere, what Tesla fortunately called the electromagnetic transmission, he was actually looking at transmissions through ground currents. These were longitudinal currents, led him to argue that actually the ether was electric and propagated through longitudinal waves. By the way, that's ambipolar energy right there, because ambipolar waves are indeed, they propagate longitudinally, not transversely, like electromagnetic waves, so to speak. And so his discovery was to optimize the transmission of power using resonance circuits and utilizing ground currents. That doesn't mean that, you know, the system could also not pick up the 10% that travels or so through the atmospheric medium, but the important thing was to be able to pick up the ground currents. That's actually the beginning of, if you will, the ether motor. Later, he actually got patents where, through precisely the system of transmission, and patent actually describes it as a power transmission system, he could operate all sorts of devices, electrical devices, including a motor. And as it turns out, the motors that Wilhelm Reich used, which were produced by the Bell laboratories, they were so-called KS motors, spinner motors. They were actually created for an electro-analog computer. In those days, people used to call them predictors, predictors of elevation, azimuth, altitude, and they were used basically as gun directors. This was very important during the Second World War, when, you know, basically computing took over all operations of firing artillery and firing rockets, obviously. And so these spinners, they were developed. Essentially, the spinner is what's called in engineering a drag cup motor. It's a special kind of induction motor where there is proportionality between the RPM and the voltage that is imparted to the two-phase stator. And it permits you to have very fast computations. You probably have heard about the Turing machine and about Turing himself and how he collaborated during the Second World War in the project that the British intelligence called MKUltra carried on to break German codes, particularly naval codes, of the so-called Enigma machine. Well, Turing, in the British establishment at, I forget now the name of the building, famous establishment of the British Security Service. So what was he doing? And this we discovered, if you will, by experimental inductance, inductive reasoning using experimental tools. In several of the demonstrations, he had Tesla coil inside of the laboratory or outside in the grounds. And he basically had a system, a complicated system of tubes, that he had to tune and to split, hence the factor Y, to split the incoming ambipolar radiation so as to be able to show capture of this energy and the rotation of this spinner motor. Now, of course, in his time, there were no passive rectifiers, you know, and even shortly thereafter, silicon control rectifiers, you still had to pump in energy to the grid in order to make them separate charges, or basically separate charges that have been activated by the absorption of ambipolar energy. Now, curiously enough, again, the first fellow to actually create such rectifiers and do it magnetically was Tesla. Tesla used a magnetic system to actually separate the positive and negative phase of the incoming Tesla radiation signals that he was using to transmit power at a distance. So a great deal of what Reich was doing, whether he realized it or not, and he probably didn't, because I suspect that Reich would have given Tesla more credit had he been aware that Tesla had already done most of it in perhaps even better ways, because I don't know for a fact that Reich was using resonance. You can drive this, you can transmit power at a distance and capture part of it with a system that's not tuned. But Tesla was actually using tune systems with full resonance. And that is actually one of the important things about, let's call it, the ether motor.
Can you describe what tuned actually means?
Well, tuned means that, let's say, if you transmit at X number of cycles per second, and you have some characteristic on your emitter, both inductance and capacitive characteristics, you need to match those characteristics at the receiver in order to optimize reception at that same frequency. That situation is a situation of resonance. And when that happens, the current that you're capturing increases dramatically to maximum. So without resonance, you can still capture part of that current. For instance, you know, if you have a variety of emitters so that you have actually a broad spectrum of emission, you cannot tune to a broad spectrum. I mean, think about the radio when you move the dial. As you go through a set of frequencies, the reason why you pick a particular station at a particular frequency is because at that point, the combination of the antenna and the inductances associated with the receiver are in tune with signal. But you've also made the experience, I'm sure, especially in AM, but sometimes in other frequency forms you can also find it, of having a broadband signal that blankets everything. Doesn't matter where you are. You know, it may increase towards a particular direction to a higher frequency or a lower frequency, but it's broadband. You cannot, you know, have a resonant coupling to such a signal, but such a signal can wipe out if it has sufficient strength. If the power that is being transmitted is sufficiently strong, it can wipe out your pinpointed resonant transmission on a particular frequency. So if you want to think of it in terms of, you know, electromagnetism, is the difference between a monochromatic electromagnetic radiation and a broad chroma radiation where, you know, you have a Gaussian distribution of frequencies, you know. So resonance really requires some matching of the source, of the receiver, to the characteristics of the source.
Okay, appreciate you going into detail. And you were saying that that was key to the ether motor.
Well, it was also key to this patent that I was referring to that Tesla filed regarding transmission of power at a distance,
right,
and of those lectures that I was mentioning. So he was really the guy who discovered that. Now, whether, you know, such a system can be used for more than just optimizing power that's transmitted at a distance, that's up for grabs. I mean, some of our work that we published in actually the first volume of what we call the ether motor, when we published that first book, we'd like to publish the second volume too, but in the first volume we talk about, in essence, the situation of resonance and how the transmission never goes, of course, above 100%, so you don't have any excess energy that way. But if you use a cavity with certain characteristics that has, let's say, sufficient energy inside, trapped inside of the cavity, it looks like it's possible to actually, in the process of transmitting power, to mobilize some energy inside of a cavity that stands in the path of transmission to get some increase of energy at the receiver. Now, obviously, you know, it's difficult to make these measurements very accurately. I mean, I don't have millions of dollars. My laboratory doesn't run like CERN. We don't have money to waste. But if I had money to waste, I certainly wouldn't mind to investigate that question further. But it opens up the question, for instance, of, you know, let's say intergalactic or extragalactic travel on so-called, they're called UFOs, unknown flying objects, which a lot of it is crap, but few incidents are obviously, and we know today, because recently the Trump White House did declassify actually stuff that goes back to 2003, 2006, and so on, which are clear examples of devices that work on the basis of electric anti-gravity and can do terrific feats. They are, of course, within the Earth's atmosphere when they are sighted, But if they actually are traveling in spaces that are either galactic or extragalactic, would they be able to couple to, beacons of bipolar radiation like pulsar stars in the same way that Tesla or Reich or Alexander and I did it with the ITER motor? Who knows? I mean, pulsars basically work in the millisecond to the second. It's possible, I mean, even with existing technology. But I doubt that that is the source of power that these devices use. I think that they use something else. But that question cannot be answered. I don't have an answer to it.
Is the ether energy using an ether to mechanical conversion, and is it successful? Can you move a generator using energy captured from an orgone accumulator or from our own bodies, or as mentioned in...
Our bodies, no.
Let's just go into the orgone accumulator. Can that actually work?
Well, really, the orgone accumulator in this context is just an antenna, really. It's no more than an antenna. It's a cavity that, if it's properly closed, and let's say as a temperature differential towards the environment that is optimized, and that can be 20, 30 degrees, the energy that's there in latent thermal form can be mobilized in the context of receiving a signal to add some energy to that signal. So it's no more than that, really. And human body is limited. In this book, we actually show how that works. The Israelis and Soviets 20 years ago tried to extract energy from the human body electrically. And the body the body defends itself. It's smarter. And we showed actually the mechanism, the electrical mechanism that the body uses to defend itself, and how it's never possible to take from the human body more than a few microwatts. So that's out of the question. In the case of, you know, the demonstrations we gave with the ITER motor, remember what I said, we have transmitters at a distance mobilizing through the ground, so it's energy that we pick because we are in the field. It's not energy that it's our body coughing it out, producing it and generating it. That would deplete us pretty good. And those experiments, you know, they were on the 10 to 100 watts. Range. And so it's not going to be from an orgone accumulator, it's not going to be from the human body. But from, you know, objects like stars or pulsars, it's conceivable. Or if you recall, Tesla wanted to use a fantastic tower that would generate a spheric envelope of Tesla radiation that could be captured at a distance by all sorts of, objects, whether they were flying objects or whether they were, you know, appliances and utilities at a distance or even moving cars. His idea was really the transmission of power through the ground coupled to the atmosphere, but secondarily, so, as I explained, would be able to power, you know, electrically at a distance. So he's the inventor of the wireless, undoubtedly. You see how many inventions this man had.
It's not the wireless using microwaves or millimeter waves, right?
No. That wireless is actually, you see, the higher you go in frequency, the more and more difficult it actually becomes to transmit power, you know. That's why these wireless technologies that we have today, they are limited to, you know, a few meters. And terrific losses they have, right? I mean, the powers that you have on your primary emitter are never matched by the powers you have on the cell phone that is being charged wirelessly. It will be a fraction. So these are very wasteful techniques, in fact. They are similar in that way to the Tesla electric vehicle, because in order to have those lithium batteries, just think about the cost, not just ecological, but the cost of manufacture. And they are obviously a fire hazard that's poorly controlled. But above all, in order to actually produce that electrical energy that's going to be stored in those batteries, you have to have some other source, whether it's hydrocarbon burning, whether it is nuclear. Every step entails a loss. So to create, you know, systems that are just purely capture systems, then you have to go in a different direction, like Alexander and I showed with our invention of so-called Iborac technology. That's where we took the concept of the orgone accumulator. such as Reich, presented it, you know, outdoors, exposed to the sun. How does it perform when you compare it to a photovoltaic panel? We found that a simple, you know, 8-inch cube or 1-foot cube accumulator properly insulated with the right fuel actually could capture more energy from the solar radiation than the photovoltaic panels, whether amorphous or crystalline, can do it by 2 to 3 times. So there is pure capture. You don't have, you know, in essence, any real loss, just like in photovoltaics. You know, the loss is, you know, how long can the panel go without cracking? How good is the film? If it's made in China, you already know it's crap anyway. Just look at all those panels that were sold under Solyndra and other things that Obama put together. They were just basically eating the money of the taxpayers, and what came out on the other side? 20-year warranties, and companies appeared in 4 to 5 years. Who's going to honor those warranties? Films cracked. They are useless. So, you know, it all depends on that, the design of that receiver. A photovoltaic panel is nothing but a receiver, really, at the end of the day. So technology that captures passively has the problem of wear and tear. Whether it's a wind machine, whether it's a photovoltaic panel, whether it's our Iborac technology. I mean, of course, in our case, we minimize wear and tear to the very minimum. What's going to happen to a box that is sits day in and day out receiving energy from the sun and can deliver it through the night because of a difference in temperature towards the environment? You know, if you couple to that, as we did, a geothermal pipe designed in a particular way, you're running around the clock, not just from solar radiation, but also from geothermal heat. And you can do these things, and these are very, even though I have not found a single investor that wants to put the money in this project.
Not yet.
No. I mean, over the years, many billionaires and so-called angel investors and utilities and corporations have come through our labs, but for a reason or the other, whether it's one technology or another, whether it's the plasma technology or the ether motor technology or this Iborac technology I was just describing to you, we've never had any takers for many reasons. Perhaps at the end of the day, all the reasons well subsumed come down to a few factors, but factors that have to do with control and factors that have to do with profit. But aside from that, you know, systems that are capture-based systems, their problem is wear and tear. For systems of transmission is the efficiency, obviously. For systems that are more sophisticated, that might be, let's say, tapping the energy of the atom or tapping the energy of the vacuum state, it's a little different ballgame.
Definitely. I wanted to ask you if the etheric motor device could be scaled up or power an engine that could transport significant weight.
Well, yes. I mean, as I'm saying, it's all a question of how much energy you can. Look, we don't know what it is to pass 5,000 amperes through the ground, you know. You may just burn a hole and you do it once and you cannot do it twice. So I don't think one would go that direction. To me, the future of energy lies more in extracting energy from plasmas, and in particular extracting energy from the fusion of hydrogen at room temperature. That's what I think it really, the large power that, you know, crafts and cities and our modern civilization needs to go to. It cannot go anywhere else. Anything else is going to be, you just think about in terms of propagation of signals, whether in the ground or in the atmosphere, you know, the dissipation, the heat dissipation in the air is huge. But even in the ground, it's going to occur. I mean, Tesla was aware of that when he made his claims on that 1893 lecture. He said, you know, his estimate was 95%, hoping to get to 100% as a condition of resonance. So that's for power transmission. Now, what's to say? I mean, again, we're talking about mistakes that scientists make. I'm not God. I'm not putting any limits here. I don't know the limits of what these things may yield.
That level of experimentation and further experimentation would require funds, and that's what an investor would potentially help to do.
Absolutely. We tried for 2 years with the Israeli aircraft industries. They were interested in our plasma technology, the PAGD thing that I described earlier. In the end, we went nowhere with them. They put money into a real hoax. They were burned with the hoax. They, number two, became our dear friend and actually our CEO, Mr. Uri Sudak, who died a couple of years back now, took upon himself to try and find out the investors. He came very, very close. He knocked on the doors of Bill Gates. He knocked on the doors of George Soros. I was appalled by the responses that he got, even though, you know, he fought a six-day war aboard a jet with a fellow fighter who became, I think at the time, vice president of Microsoft. Still, all of his efforts went nowhere. He got a very famous physicist, Thurman Braunover, who is now deceased too, to support our work in plasma physics. There were other billionaires in the United States, you know, Charles Intman. That's the name of the other fellow that did his fortune in apparel. I forget his name now. They were all interested, but a variety of reasons. People interfered in the middle. Gene Malov, Dr. Malov, was involved in a lot of this because him and Uri Sudak, they formed a team. And they were our front people, you know. Uri was our CEO, and Gene was the man in charge of both the educational and finding investors. And so many of them strung them along. There were others involved with this. A friend of ours, Jack Eisenberg, then a broker in two important financial houses. These people traveled. I remember once Uri went to England. This would have been something like 2006 or so. After the third approach to George Soros, which was very difficult to actually see the man. He's so surrounded by apparatchik, you know. But at the third, he went to a fellow that he knew. Let's call him Mr. A. His name is actually Alexander. And they composed together some... This story is actually on the web. And, you know, he was able to get like seven... Because George Soros had told basically Mr. Sudak through the intermediary that he would put 1 million... We were asking 22 million to develop the plasma system. He would put 1 million if we could find 19 others or 20 others and put 1 million each. He didn't want anybody in control, but he didn't want to actually pay the bill, foot the bill. So Uri patiently put together, you know, I think it was on seven or so. There was a company, venture capital company from California. Xander himself was going in with monies. Some other people were. And then there was the second largest oil company in England, Premier Oil Company. We presented our budget plan, which we had worked with him and revised it as years went by. You know, at the end of his presentation, there was a discussion, and the fellow representing the oil company, the Premier Oil Company, raised the question, but these people, meaning the inventors, me and Alexandra, they want control, economic control of the company, 51%, and they want control of the R&D. And that's never done. You know, as inventors, they'll get 3 or 4%. We never give control of the R&D to the inventors. Is this negotiable? And Uri said, no, it's not negotiable. That's what they want, and I'll be CEO, and we have technical people, you know, who'll do milestones, provide you with reports, and, you know, and so on and so forth. And the guy had the gall of turning around and saying, so what, they are banking on this patent that they are wanting to sell to us or license to us, and they want control 51% until the first product. Well, you know, they can wait 17 years. That nothing is going to happen. In the end, the patents will expire. Oil will still be there. And when we need, we'll go and reproduce their patents. And he walked out. So we have a similar event with General Motors. Also, it's described in our website, I believe. And as you very well know, this business of the solar and this business of the wind is the biggest hoax ever created. I mean, they sucked money from every state under the FIT program. They enriched their friends in government, corporations that were involved. It's one of the biggest hoax ever perpetrated. Put a pile of states in Europe and the United States into terrific debt. And they're not renewable. I mean, you take down one of those wind generator propellers, and you're talking about $1 million just to take them down, $1 million to put them up, and $500,000 a day for the amount of work that it's not doing, and so on and so forth. These are methods to bankrupt states and societies, and they're all done at the cost of taxpayers, so it's a huge hoax. I don't have words for it, because if there was any interest, really, the thrust should have been to decentralize power-generating technologies, and it should have been to pursue the research that General Electric was doing in vacuum arcs, the work that we're doing in abnormal glow discharges that were pulsed autogenously, or the work that we did with the Iborac, or even exploring precisely the question of, you know, room temperature, low energy fusion reactions. That's not the way they have gone, and that's not the way I anticipate neither the corporate, the military, or the governmental bureaucratic spheres are going.
I'm guessing, but it seems to me they've already developed that level of experimentation into some usable form, and they may put up blocks and interference in the public sector.
I don't believe that. The thesis of Steve Greer in the project disclosure, I think that's a pile of crap, to be honest with you, put simply. No, their science wouldn't permit them. Their math would not permit them. Their understanding would not permit. You have to see that science is like a language, and mathematics is a language, and its virtue is that it's not an accurate language of quantities. It's also a language of quantities with quality. You know, an oxen goes up the hill, but an oxen does not go up the hill. You know, so it's you cannot cut an ox in halves and expect the halves to go halfway up the hill. No, unfortunately, quantum mechanics, the way it exists, and the generalizations already of relativity, and relativity is not a certifiable theory by any means, I think has blocked a lot of progress. The business of the quarks in 1960s was a real killer. This notion that, you know, everything breaks apart into three sums and that there are six quarks. I mean, if you look at the evidence for that kind of physics and the last two quarks that are now accepted, it's a joke, you know. Two or three years later, after the interaction, that's when you get actually the detection. Synthesis, that's not fact. And so, no, I don't believe for a moment that the United States government has any knowledge, practical knowledge of, let's say, anti-gravitational propulsion techniques, or even has cracked the business of nuclear fusion at room temperature. No, I don't, not for a moment.
Dr. Eugene Malov was one of your good friends and a supporter. What drew him to your work, and would you tell listeners more about Dr. Malov in this context?
Well, I presented the work on plasmas that Alexander and I had carried on for some 10 years in 1996 at the ISNE3, the New Energy Conference. This was in Colorado. Gene missed my lecture, but he had heard that it had caused the commotion. And so we were in the hall having a discussion, and Harold Aspen, a British physicist, a very dear friend of ours, who also now is deceased, he brought Gene over and said, "Did you hear Paulo's lecture, blah, blah, blah?" And Gene was, no, I really want it. And right there and then, he asked me if I could deliver it again. So I did. And we became very good friends. He loved it. And then he started to explore not just, you know, our connection to the work of Reich, but the electrodynamic aspect of fusion, and he started to realize that, you know, all along, so-called cold fusioneers have been barking up the wrong tree with basically a mythological reaction that nobody has ever seen to explain the so-called excess heat of the Pons-Fleischmann experiment, which, by the way, you know, Jean had been instrumental in bringing up, highlighting it, because he was at the time the director of the MIT, a review journal.
Yeah.
He detected that when the thing was being published, some people had taken upon themselves to move the original line of Pons and Fleischmann down so as to suggest there's actually loss of energy. And Jean got really upset with these unethical, and so he became, after that, pretty much the front man, the banner of the cold fusion movement. By the time he met us, he was getting very disillusioned with quality of research, with, again, little chapels, but here of interest, pushing forth theories, highly mathematical, that had actually no experimental basis. So, you know, for a few years in there, he gave us, between 96 and 2001, he gave us a lot of coverage. I published, Alexander and I and some of our co-workers published almost exclusively in Infinite Energy Journal that he created and was the editor and the chief publisher. And then my work veered off towards... you see, I detected that there was something really wrong with physics behind the claims of the cold fusioneers, and spent a lot of time investigating and even going further than that. Ended up by writing a whole volume that I intended in 2000 to publish about basically a traumatic nuclear fusion. I gave that up, but Jean was the only person in the world that actually read the book. I never published it. After that, he was beside himself. He realized that we had discovered the actual pathways of branching for the reactions of deuterides, that we had solved the problems of the ash.
Was this before his book, Fire from Ice?
No, this was after. This was after. Today, well, several times they said he would review what he had written on his book. You know, we ended up with all of the right for our communications with him. He explicitly gave them to us. We never published it. One day we will, I guess. And it's quite telling because he went on about the entire field. I mean, by the time the ICCF-10 had come around, Jean was absolutely convinced that the only pathway to solve the problem of fusion was the one that we were proposing and not the one that basically the Office of Naval Research and other people that were also members of the New Energy Foundation were pushing forward. So there was a huge split, you know. In those years, Jean came to see Alexander and I as his best friends, several times said that, and felt very isolated. And there was a lot of shenanigans that happened inside of his laboratory. People tried to move him out. His partner, Jed Rothwell, behaved really badly, but even worse than him, others tried to take control of his sponsors. Believe it or not, they turned on him for being Jewish. It's unbelievable that these people would be so Judeophobic or such Jew haters that they would try to actually take away, wrestle control from the very laboratory that Jean had taken so much trouble to put together. Anyway, these were bad times. We have never published these stories. They were very ugly, very, very ugly. Left him and us with a terrible bad taste. In fact, in the year before he was murdered, we had created a company together called Ethera. And he wanted entirely to leave the journal, even perhaps close it, but certainly pass it to somebody else. That was part of the reason why he picked on the guy who's still, I believe, the present-day chief editor of it, Bill Ziver, a fellow that proved to be quite treacherous and a liar to a first order. But in those days, he still had hopes. So did we. We actually banked a lot on Bill supporting our work. He made a lot of statements about that, and then he went right behind us and pulled the rug. But that doesn't matter, you know, it's all water under the bridge. Seeing those people are seeing the Reichians, so-called self-styled Reichians in action, you know that people that are like that, they have nothing to offer. All they are looking for is to see who can they steal something from, whom can they steal something from. You know, unfortunately, there's a lot of people like that, particularly when there was this hope back in the 90s and early 21st century, this hope that, you know, we'll be able to have a breakthrough in one of these realms. But yet the breakthroughs were there, and they were short-circuiting them. A lot of bad stories. I'm not sure I want to get into any of that.
We don't have to go into some of those, because you definitely described some important areas, and I didn't know how bad it was for Dr. Malov. He was certainly outspoken and extremely articulate and detail-oriented in showing some of the inconsistencies in the approaches to new sciences by the scientific community.
For us, was actually, he was our, you know, Gene was very involved. I mean, if you go to heterometry.com and you look up a thing called In Honor of Our Friends, it has a small, you know, abstract of how involved Dr. Malov was with all of our efforts, both the efforts to commercialize as well as the efforts to disseminate information and educate people. So, yes, he was a very dear friend, I have to tell you. We became very intimate before he was so cruelly murdered. Don't have words for it.
It's so tragic. We had a guest on last week. His name is Russ Gerst, to talk in detail about that and about his book, Fire from Ice, and some of the people that were working against him. But I didn't know that he was your really good friend, and it was just a coincidence to reach out to you and find that it was the case. It's amazing that he was interested in this realm. I had no idea. In a 2002 radio interview with Dr. Malov, he mentioned that NASA and other government agencies did consider etheric energy sources for propulsion. Would you talk about that, please?
Well, I am not sure exactly what he was referring to. Of course, there is the work of Harold Puthoff and zero-point energy people who believe that, you know, through the Casimir effect and so on, you can tap the vacuum state. I know that Gene came to realize that it didn't work. Maybe he was referring to that because there has been a definite, you know, it's politicized, you know, it's connected to well-moneyed families, some connected to the Clinton Foundation and so on, that truly others to, you know, even people that we worked with for a while. I mean, there was a fellow billionaire that we became very good friends with during that period, and he was part of that crowd. Later, he lost a great deal of his fortune in Italy. But, you know, none of these people, they wanted to politicize the issue far. First of all, they didn't have sufficient science, and secondly, politicizing the issue the wrong way never sat well with me, or with Gene, by the way. There was a lot of, you know, politics behind this, not just, you know, scientific disagreements. I would say the disagreements on science were rather minor, because most of these characters, they actually were not interested one little bit in our work or in the advice given to them. Look at what happened with the ICCF-10 when Gene published his, gave a lecture and published a very long dissertation, really. And he advised them repeatedly to consider electrodynamics, to consider our work, to consider the work of black light and so on, Randall Mills' black light. And they basically turned their backs on everything he advised them. It's if you go to heterometry.com, you will see actually several of his interviews, as well as a lot of discussions about, certainly in the interviews that we gave during that period, 2001, 2002, 2003, Well, we mentioned names, or we mentioned, you know, the manipulations that were going on, and it was all for nothing, the funny thing, because Rossi didn't come out with a reactor. None of these people actually came out with a solution when it comes to nuclear fusion. And even when it comes to electrodynamics and other stuff like that, what has come out of it? I mean, the work of Bedini is sort of a bit of an imitation of the work that Alexander and I were doing in vacuum. And there's a few others, too, that try to, you know, basically appropriate our work for their purposes. Did they go anywhere? No, they didn't, you know. So today we are really looking at the dearth of science and the dearth of investment in any of these different avenues that I'm talking about. I mean, it's pretty bad as far as I'm concerned.
I really hope that's about to change. And, you know, seeing people in the streets protesting, I always look at it as, wow, what if they were protesting against the downplaying of cold fusion? Imagine if there was that level of response to get the U.S. government or corporations or people to understand this technology can be produced. We can transition away. And even the climate change folks, they don't even get involved with free energy or...
Because global warming is really a myth. I mean, it's just the problem of pollution revisited and basically an ideological political robe. We wrote in 2005 a real big denunciation of global warming. Actually made it to the House of Representatives. It was one of the three studies that was quoted. You might want to look that up in our website.
Dr. Correa, I just want to mention your website. Your website is etherometry.com, and that's AETHEROMETRY.com.
And there is another one dedicated more to the medical sciences. You can get to it through etherscience.com, or you can get to it through ABRISCI.com. That stands for Aurora Biophysics Research Institute, ABRI, and SCI is science. So South China India, SCI.com. You can get to that other website through either one of those two pathways, and they have different things in them. As I'm saying, the latter is more directed towards the medical and biological sciences, whereas etherometry is more directed towards physics and biophysics. Well, I was about to comment, you know, I'm an old folk right now. I'm in my, I feel young in mind, but I'm an old folk. I am a dinosaur of sorts. But when I was young, right or wrong, spirit of rebellion amongst my friends, both in the old country and here in Canada, was constructive. Kids wanted to learn, you know. They were thirsty to know. I was thirsty to know. It has been an impelling factor in all my life. But today's kids and these movements that we see, they are media-manufactured events, you know. The corporate world has taken over, and social media complies with the interests of the world. And it's really a certain, let me use the word, immediatism. There's a... Things have to be given on a platter right away. They have to be immediate. If they are not immediate, and life doesn't work like that. You have to learn patiently. You have to study. You know, that part is missing a lot from the youth today. They rely on a terrible machine. If they truly wanted to change the world, they probably should, all of them, discard their stupid cell phones. You know, I don't own a cell phone to this day, and I'm very glad I don't. I think that they are a terrible invention. Just consider this. America, the United States, which arguably still has a constitutional system, up until the year 2000, the great concern of, you know, young people, and myself included, was to protect our liberties and not let the state, government, corporate world control us, our identities, what we do and how we do it. Well, after the huge invasion of society by cell phones, we gave away all the data, all our personal data to the Googles, to social media companies, to God knows, everybody and anybody. CIA didn't need to spy on us illegally anymore. you know, now we are offering our own data, you know. It's a change. The world has done 180 degrees. People are no longer afraid, as if, you know, somehow the power systems wouldn't have power over them. They do. They have a lot more power today than they did 20 years ago. But people act as if they are not afraid to provide that data. And on the other hand, you have these huge events of hysteria, paroxysms of hysteria, fear, alarmism. Look at this COVID story. I mean, it's a hoax in many ways, you know. Yes, it probably was the result. I should know, since I did my master's in virology and biophysics. I believe that something got out from those laboratories in Wuhan. The sequencing, the molecular sequencing, the DNA sequencing of the virus suggests that for the assemblages of so-called spike protein and associate proteins on the surface of the virion, that's the coat of the protein coat of the virus. But the thing is a dud. It's a Chinese dud, you know. It kills people of a certain age group that have had certain medical interventions. There are people that are being treated with same medications all across the board, from here to Italy. Medications against hypertension, medications against diabetes or pro-diabetic, diabetic syndromes, medications against chronic renal disease, and medications against acid reflux, basically those inhibitors of so-called proton pump in stomach. All these medications, they alter the biology, the healthy biology of the body. And recent studies on the question of COVID have shown that the virus enters cells through an interaction with a receptor for a protein responsible for the regulation of blood pressure called an angiotensinogen. This receptor is modified by precisely a whole class of hypertensive drugs. So instead of our medical establishment protecting the populations that we knew already, or very early during the beginning of the pandemic, knew that they were at risk, you know, people who are being treated for these conditions, instead of protecting them, in particularly in old age homes, we went around destroying the economy, you know, acting as if this virus could infect young kids. In fact, young people, the youth, develop very fast responses to all sorts of coronavirus. Coronavirus has been around for thousands and thousands of years, you know. Just because a laboratory tinkers with one does not mean that the thing actually is a germ warfare bomb. Most likely it's a dud, and I'm saying this is a dud. And a lot of the statistics that we see, they are cooked. You know, ask yourself, where are the statistics for the state of New York or for New York City regarding influenza infections or symptomatic pleurisy or pneumonia for the months of February all the way until present? They disappeared. Everybody that dies of COVID. There's a guy with blood alcohol of 0.55, he dies of COVID. There's even people who have been shot and they're put in as COVID. So we are in the throes of a gigantic media-making, event-manufacturing hoax. And it's destroying not just the United States, it's destroying the world economy from within, you know. This is a stupidity of first order. So we are not afraid of giving away our data, but we live in a perpetual climate of, you know, hysteria, alarmism, and fear. Something very wrong. Something very wrong with psychology of modern people. It's like a desire to die. It's perhaps the very basis of why we've had fascisms and wars in the past, is this desire for self-abolition, to self-destruct, to destroy things. It's on this, Reich wrote very profound words, perhaps more than anybody else, how societies fabricate this socially produced, this culturally produced death instinct, and then provide different ways from war to now more modern methods of destruction that we know, including germ warfare, destroying everything in its path, you know. I didn't give credit to all the co-workers that worked with me. I couldn't have done this work, nor Alexandra. Certainly not without Alexandra, and certainly not without a number of co-workers that, to me, were, you know, people that to which I have a debt of infinite gratitude and friendship. And aside from Dr. Malov and Dr. Rui Jorge Silva, there's a great friend of ours with whom we have been living now for 20 years, Dr. Malgorzata Skanes, mathematician and logician, who is the person responsible for our websites, and she has done a fantastic job of editing, checking, website construction. She's a very, very, very special person. So, and like her, probably nobody, but many other co-workers that over the years have shared in research and whose names are in various papers we published. You must understand, I could not have done this alone. It's pretty obvious. It's well over 4,500 pages that are published on the web now. I could not have done it by myself. So I have a debt of gratitude to these friends and co-workers that can never be paid back.
I understand that as well, and I see that and have seen it coming for a number of years, especially with the advent of the portable communication device that people carry around with them. It's quite something. Well, Dr. Paulo Correa, learning about your work is fascinating, and I really appreciate you going into detail about the research you've done on mass free energy and other similar technologies that you've spent so many years working on and developing. I want to continue learning more about this realm. And again, I want to thank you for being on Another News. It was such a delight.
Well, thank you very much for giving me a chance to speak publicly and openly about these issues, which affect all of us. And I hope we can do it again sometime if you feel like it. There's a lot of stuff in here to talk about. And people indeed need to be informed, but in a different way than they are being informed right now. Thank you very much, Jeff. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.